and a set of abelian gauge fields, which I denote by mu I. And in this theory, I define an extremal spherically symmetric black hole to be the one which has a near horizon geometry of the following form. This geometry, that this background that I have written down, is the most general one that is consistent with the symmetries of ADS2 times S2, namely it's the most general background configuration that is consistent with the SO2, 1 symmetry of ADS2 and the SO3 symmetry of S2. Now, one advantage that we saw for this background was that all the relevant field strengths had vanishing covariant derivative. So in particular, the scalars, of course, being constants, have a vanishing derivative. The gauge field strengths, the electric field strength and the magnetic field strength, being proportional to the volume form on ADS2 and the volume form on S2, are also covariantly constant. And finally, because this is the both ADS2 and S2 are maximally symmetric spaces, the Riemann tensor calculated from this metric can be reconstructed in terms of the metric itself. So in particular, along the RT direction that spans ADS2, the Riemann tensor was given by this formula over here, this being the metric on ADS2. And along the sphere direction, along the S2 direction, labeled by theta and phi, the components of the Riemann tensor was given by this formula over here. And this makes it clear that the Riemann tensors also have vanishing covariant derivative. And as a result, even if the original starting Lagrangian is a complicated one, which involves not only the various field strengths, their higher powers and their covariant derivatives, eventually the part of the Lagrangian that is important, that is relevant for analysis of these black holes, is the one which contains, which may contain arbitrary high powers of the field strengths and the Riemann tensor and the scalar fields, but no covariant derivatives of the field strengths or the Riemann tensor or the scalar fields. So with this background geometry, we did the following. Suppose the Lagrangian density of the system is given by this quantity Carly L, which, as I said, can be an arbitrary function of the various field strengths and Riemann tensors. We define a function f as a function of the various parameters which label this background, the scalar field values, the sizes of S2 and ADS2, as well as the electric and magnetic field. Simply, by evaluating this Lagrangian density on the background, on the near horizon background of the black hole, and carrying out the angular integral. And then we define another function, capital F, as a function of u, v, the electric field E, a new variable, new set of variables Q and P, by this relation over here. And then we derive the following relations. We derive that for an extremal black hole carrying electric charge Q and magnetic charge P, the near horizon values of the scalar fields, the electric field, and the sizes of ADS2 and S2 are obtained simply by extremizing this function f with respect to the corresponding variables. So we simply take this function f that has been defined here and find an extremum of this function with respect to the variables u, v, and e, which is given here. These equations determine the near horizon values of all these parameters. And once you have determined the near horizon values of all these parameters by solving these equations, the black hole entropy is given simply by the function itself evaluated at the extremum. So this was a result for the in four dimensions, and we said that similar results also hold for higher dimensional black holes. So what I plan to do first is to briefly go through the corresponding analysis for higher dimensional black holes. I'll not give any of the details, but just outline the basic steps that goes into this analysis. But before I go on, let me ask if there are any questions. OK, so let me then begin with the generalization to dimension larger than 4. So here, we consider a theory of gravity coupled to scalars, as before, and antisymmetric tensor gauge fields of different rank. Okay, in 4 dimensions, the only antisymmetric tensor gauge field that you can think of is the vector field, A mu, because we know that the antisymmetric rank 2 tensor can be dualized to a scalar. Okay, and that's what he used to simply say that we only consider scalars and vectors and nothing else. But in a generic higher dimensional theory, at least from our experience in string theory, we know that we have to deal with theories with antisymmetric tensor fields of different ranks. So let's assume that we have such a theory. In this theory, we define a spherically symmetric extremal black hole to be the one which has the following features. It should have near horizon geometry, ADS 2 times SD minus 2. This is a direct generalization of what we had in the 4 dimensional case. And I should perhaps also say that if we construct the extremal Reisner-Nordstrom solution in higher dimension, their near horizon geometry is in fact given by this geometry over here. So it's not something which is completely unheard of. The usual extremal black holes, spherically symmetric extremal black holes in higher dimensional theories of gravity do have this feature. And then, as before, I'll demand that all background fields are invariant under the SO2,1 times SOT minus 1 symmetry of this ADS2 times SD minus 2 background spacetime. Okay, this is again a direct generalization of what we had in 4 dimension. And again, I should say that this is what happens for an extremal Reisner-Nordstrom black hole in higher dimensional theories. So with this ansatz, we proceed exactly as in the 4 dimensional case. So the first step is to write down the most general background consistent with these symmetries. And here it is. So let me try to explain the various symbols which have appeared here. So first line, of course, gives the metric associated with the ADS2 times SD minus 2. So the ADS2 part has exactly the same form as before. V1, the coefficient multiplying this, being the size of ADS2. And this d omega d minus 2 square is the line element on a unit d minus 2 sphere. Okay, a line element on an SD minus 2 of unit size. And we multiply this metric by V2 because a priori the size of SD minus 2 is an arbitrary parameter which is to be determined. Then all the scalar fields have to take constant values. So phi s must be equal to some constant Cs. The gauge fields, we can see that there's a symmetry that the fact that we have to have an SO2, you have to have a symmetry of ADS2 and also of SD minus 2 tells us that the gauge field, the non-trivial components of the gauge fields, can appear only along ADS2. Why? Because if we want a non-trivial component along SD minus 2, what you have to construct is a two-form, okay, is an invariant two-form on a d minus 2 sphere. And a T minus 2 sphere doesn't have a invariant 2 form in general, okay, except for D equal to 4. Right? A 2 sphere, of course, has a volume form, which is invariant under the spherical symmetric group. But if you have a D minus 2 dimensional sphere, we cannot write down an antisymmetric rank 2 tensor on that D minus 2 dimensional sphere that is invariant under the SOD minus 1 group. So the gauge fields can take only electric type values. However, if there are antisymmetric rank, antisymmetric tensor fields of rank D minus 3, so that their corresponding field strength is a tensor field of rank D minus 2, then those can have non-zero values along SD minus 2. Why? Because on SD minus 2, we can write down naturally a D minus 2 form that is invariant under the symmetric group of SD minus 2, and that is simply the volume form on the D minus 2 sphere. Right? The volume form on D minus 2 sphere is a tensor of rank D minus 2, is an antisymmetric tensor of rank D minus 2. So if you have in the theory an antisymmetric tensor field whose field strength is of rank D minus 2, we can switch those on in the near horizon geometry. And in fact, these are the only kinds of fields that you can switch on in the near horizon geometry. So that's what I have written here. D omega 2 D minus 2 square, I have already explained, is the line element on the D minus 2 sphere. So H D minus 2 is nothing but the metric on unit D minus 2 sphere. This is the field strength associated with the antisymmetric tensor D minus 3 form fields. So in particular, if the theory doesn't have an antisymmetric tensor D minus 3 form field, it cannot have a magnetic type background. Right? That's what this says. Because otherwise, it will be inconsistent with the symmetries of SD minus 2. This omega D minus 2, which appears here, is by definition the area of unit D minus 2 sphere. If you remember, in the labeling of the four-dimensional background, I had taken the corresponding magnetic field to be pi over 4 pi. Right? And this 4 pi here is generalized to omega D minus 2. And the reason that I have included this factor in the normalization is because if you carry out the angular integral of this object, the angular integral will generate a factor of omega D minus 2. And that's what is going to cancel this factor in the denominator. These coordinates, XLI, these coordinate indices which are appearing here, are simply coordinates along the sphere. Okay, that's why H has indices labeled by the L's. And finally, this epsilon is a totally antisymmetric symbol defined by this. Okay, so epsilon 2, 3, 4 up to D minus 1 is 1. And if you exchange any two of these indices, you pick up a minus sign according to the number of permutations. So this is the general background that you can write down that is consistent with the symmetries of S2 times S, or symmetries of ADS2 times SD minus 2. And from here on, the analysis proceeds exactly as in the four-dimensional case. So we define this function f as a function of the parameters that label the background simply by integrating the Lagrangian density over the D minus 2 dimensional sphere. Then we define the function capital F as 2 pi times the Legendre transform of the function small f. And by proceeding exactly as in the four-dimensional case, one can show that the parameters U and V are obtained by extremizing this function capital F, and the black hole entropy is given simply by the function capital F at this extremum. And the reason that the analysis is identical to the four-dimensional case is because the formula for the entropy that I wrote down in terms of the derivative of the action with respect to the curve, with respect to the Riemann tensor, is identical in higher dimension. Okay, so the same formula is applicable in higher dimension. And if you apply the same formula, you will obviously get back the same relation. Now, there is one assumption in this analysis. And the assumption is that the part of the Lagrangian which is relevant for the construction of black hole solution depends only on the field strengths and not on the gauge fields. Right? Because I have, when you evaluate this Lagrangian, I have used the fact that a Lagrangian must be a scalar, okay, so that it doesn't depend on the coordinates of ADS2. Otherwise, this quantity will start depending on the coordinates of ADS2. So we don't have to assume necessarily that the Lagrangian doesn't contain any Chern-Simons type term. But what you have to assume is that even if Chern-Simons type terms are present in the Lagrangian, when you actually use that Lagrangian to analyze the black hole solution, the Chern-Simons type terms don't contribute. And in all known cases, this seems to be true simply by the symmetry consideration. Okay, the background that you are looking at has a high degree of symmetry, and that essentially seems to show that the Chern-Simons type terms automatically vanish. The contribution from the Chern-Simons type terms automatically vanish when you try to analyze this kind of background. But nevertheless, this is something that you have to check every time, that if there are Chern-Simons type terms present in the Lagrangian, then we should make sure that they don't affect the analysis of the black hole solution. Okay, are there any questions? That's right, yeah. Yeah, that the near horizon geometry shouldn't be affected by Chern-Simons. Because this L has to be evaluated only near horizon, right? So you need this L to be a scalar only near the horizon. I suspect so, that it should apply to the BMP. Although, I mean, I haven't checked it explicitly. Yeah. Yeah, I found it somewhat hard to cook up such a thing because essentially what happens is that, okay, the Chern-Simons term affect in the equation of motion, it comes as a wedge product of various fields, right? It affects the equation of motion of a field by appearing as a wedge product of field strengths. Now, either the Bianchi identity or the equations of motion. Now, because the field strengths are separated into the S2 part and the ADS2 part, the ADS2 part and the SD minus 2 part, it's very hard to cook up an example where these two will contract and give a non-zero contribution. Right? So maybe it may be possible to show that in string theory at least you don't get such terms. But I don't know if one can give a general proof that Chern-Simons terms will never happen. That also may be possible. Okay, I just haven't thought hard enough to see if there is a general proof that one can construct. But I mean, it is true that it is very hard to hook up, I mean, examples of such terms which do contribute. In particular, one can see easily that the gravitational Chern-Simons terms are never going to contribute. Because gravitational Chern-Simons terms require a contraction between the Riemann tensor from the ADS2 to Riemann tensor in SD minus 2. And there is no contraction because there is complete factorization in the Riemann tensor on ADS2 and the Riemann tensor on SD minus 2. So what could contribute is the Chern-Simons term of smothered field strengths, if there is appropriate coupling. But I mean, in all the cases that I have looked at, there is no such coupling. Yeah, that is true. So one has to generalize this analysis. So exactly this will not apply for BMPP black hole. But if you look at the details, essentially what has been used is that the space is symmetric, right? It's a homogeneous space so that you can label the background by just a set of constants. And that will be true for any homogeneous space, right? Even if the geometry is ADS3 instead of ADS2. So one has to redo this analysis, right? It's probably not that the same formula will apply there, right? But some generalization of this formula should apply in that case. Okay. So let me now go ahead and try to apply this to the computation of entropy of elementary string excitations. Now, this has been discussed in quite a detail by Samir Mathur, so I'll briefly set up the problem, and then I'll try to discuss how the analysis that we have carried out so far is relevant for calculating the entropy of elementary string excitations. So first, let me discuss the microscopic side of the problem. And this, in fact, is the part that has been discussed by Samir. So let's consider heterotic string on a product space, M times S1. S1 is just an ordinary circle. M can be any compact space of dimension less than or equal to 5. It's dimension less than or equal to 5 because we want a theory with at least 4 non-compact directions. That's why I restrict to dimension M to be of dimension less than or equal to 5. And we'll put the restriction on M that the resulting theory has at least N equal to 2 supersymmetry. Now, as I've emphasized, the results, the analysis of the classical solutions that I have carried out do not require any supersymmetry. Okay, so that part of the analysis we can for that part of the analysis, we do not need to use any supersymmetry. But when you are trying to make connection with the microscopic entropy, we have to make sure that the degeneracy of states is protected from quantum corrections. And that's where supersymmetry comes into play. Okay? So we need BPA states to ensure that the microscopic, the state counting that we're carrying out do not change as you vary the coupling constants. And that's the reason why we restrict our manifold M to have at least N equal to 2 supersymmetry. But let me emphasize again that if we are only interested in calculating the classical entropy from the geometry side, we do not need supersymmetry. So what are examples of such M? Well, the simplest example is torus, okay, torus of any dimension. Then we have K3. We are allowed up to 5 dimension, so we can use K3 times S1. And then we can take various supersymmetry preserving orbifolds of these objects. Okay? These are some of the examples of supersymmetry preserving choices of the manifold M. Okay, we will not make any further commitment as to which specific manifold we choose. So in this theory, let us consider a fundamental heterotic string that is wound along the circle S1. Okay, I have isolated the spatial circle S1 because this is the circle on which I want to wind the string. So let's take a heterotic string and wind it W times around S1, W being some arbitrary integer. And what we want to do is to study excitations of this string. And as was discussed in Samir's talk in detail, the string is a wound string can have excitations, okay, various modes of excitation, which can consist of either traveling waves moving to the left or traveling waves moving to the right. The number of independent left moving modes in this case is 24. Okay, and this is where this discussion will differ a little from Samir's discussion because he had type 2, where both on the left and the right there are 8 bosonic degrees of freedom and 4 fermionic degrees, 8 bosonic and 8 fermionic degrees of freedom. Here, what we have is 24 independent left moving bosonic modes and 8 plus 8 independent right moving modes, 8 bosonic and 8 fermionic, which essentially makes the total number of, the effective number of right moving degrees of freedom to be 12 scalars, because two fermions count as one scalars as far as counting of degrees of freedom is concerned. Now it turns out that while a generic string can have both left and right moving excitation, if you are looking for BPS states, okay, and we do want to look for BPS states, because as I said, it's only for BPS states that the degeneracy is protected from quantum corrections. BPS states involve excitations of left moving modes only. And because they involve excitations of left moving modes only, these left moving modes all carry momentum along in the towards left. And that effectively generates a net momentum along the circle. And by the usual rule of quantum mechanics, this net momentum along the circle is quantized in units of 1 over r, where r is the radius of S1. So a generic BPS state will consist of a string that winds w times along S1 and that carries total momentum n over r along S1. And we want to count the number of such BPS states. This counting again was something that was discussed in Samir's talk. Essentially, what we need to do to calculate this number is to find the number of ways we can distribute the total momentum n over r among individual modes. And this counting gives an answer. In fact, one can do the exact counting and one can get an exact expression for this degeneracy as a function of n and w. But we'll be interested in the result for large values of n and w. And what one finds is that for large values of n and w, the degeneracy of states grows exponentially in this form. Now, if you remember the result from Samir's lecture, he had exactly a similar formula, except that this 4 was replaced by 2 root 2. And the difference here is because we are using heterotic instead of type 2. So in type 2, the effective number of left moving bosonic degrees of freedom, as I said, is 12. Okay, there are 8 bosonic and 8 fermionic degrees of freedom, but 8 fermion counts as 4 bosons. So effectively, there are 12 left moving bosonic modes. Here, we have 24 left moving bosonic modes. Okay, so this number, this doubling of the number of degrees of freedom, is what gives rise to an extra factor of root 2 in the exponent and converts the 2 root 2 in his formula to 4 in this formula over here. So I'll not give much more detail of this counting, but given this number, it seems natural that we can associate a statistical entropy to this system, that a system carrying a given set of charged quantum numbers n and w has a statistical entropy, which is given by log of this degeneracy, namely 4 pi times square root of n w. So this is what we'll define to be the statistical entropy of this BPS state, which carries w units of winding and n units of momentum along this circle S1. Okay, are there any questions on this? Yeah. Yes. The reason that we count only single string, there are two ways you can look at this. The first of all, if you are counting BPS states, okay, you can show that the multiple strings don't give rise to BPS states. Okay, they are, if you take multiple string states, they are in the long multiplet, okay, not in the short multiplet. But even if you count multiple strings, okay, and count their number, you can show that the entropy is in fact dominated. Basically, the dominant contribution to the entropy remains this 4 pi square root of nw, and that's because of the exponential growth of the number of states of a single string state. Okay, so unlike in normal statistical mechanics, where multiple particle states have more entropy compared to single particle states, okay, it's more effective to distribute the total energy among multiple particles. In the case of elementary strings, that's not the case. Okay, because the a single elementary string has exponentially growing degeneracy of strings. Okay, so even if you count multiple strings, you will not get a different answer. But in this case, if you strictly want to count BPS states, you should only count single string states. Does that answer your question? Well, as long as the number of BPS states do not change as a function of the string coupling, right? And the argument as to why it doesn't change is because BPS states are in a short multiplet, right? And typically, short multiplets do not get converted to long multiplets. If the total number of states do not change discontinuously, right, then we expect that the BPS states will remain BPS as you vary the coupling constant. It's the same reason that one uses to argue why the photon remains massless even in the interacting field. Okay, there are, one of the arguments is that since photon has two polarization states, right, in order for this to acquire a mass, it needs to absorb another degree of freedom. Okay, so we'll leave aside this expression for the statistical entropy. And now we'll turn to the calculation of the entropy from the geometric side. Yes. So that is the question that was asked also, that why consider only single string states and not multiple string states and the charge being distributed among various strings, right? And as I said, even if you count multiple string states, because the degeneracy of a single string grows exponentially, okay, the entropy doesn't, you don't gain in entropy by distributing the total charge among multiple strings. Okay, unlike in the case of ordinary particles, where I mean, it's entropically much more favorable to distribute the, to say, a given amount of energy among multiple particles rather than a single particle carrying all the energy. Okay, that is not the case for strings, because a single string degeneracy of state grows exponentially. Okay. But the other point is that if you want to count only BPS states, then we should count only single string states, because multiple strings are not BPS. Right? They don't transform in the short representation of the supersymmetry algebra. Okay, and if you have a single string state, then of course that has to carry all the charges. Okay. But as I said, even if you want to count multiple string states, it doesn't alter the analysis. Okay, so since we are considering the case of large momentum and winding, this string carries large amount of energy or mass. And so one might expect that if we have sufficiently large N and W, then the system might start behaving like a black hole. What do you mean by the system might become a black hole? What I mean by the system behaving like a black hole is that it should be described by some black hole-like solution to the equations of motion derived from the effective action of string theory. If this is really the case, then we should be able to associate a Bekenstein-Hawking entropy to this black hole, which I'll denote by SBH. And if we can associate such a Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, then the natural question to ask is this Bekenstein-Hawking entropy the same as the statistical entropy that we just calculated? The reason that this question is important is because if this is true, if the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is indeed equal to the statistical entropy, then this would provide a microscopic explanation of the black hole entropy. So had this been true, we would have been very happy. Unfortunately, it turns out that answering this question is not a very straightforward job. Because the first thing one tries is to describe this configuration of a given N and W as a black hole solution of the supergravity equations of motion. Okay, equations of motion, not of the full effective action of string theory, but the supergravity approximation to this effective action. But in the supergravity approximation, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy vanishes. In fact, it vanishes because the horizon size goes to zero. And in fact, what one can show is that the horizon is singular. The geometry itself becomes singular at the horizon. Okay, it doesn't remain a smooth geometry. So this is what one finds if you try to use supergravity approximation. Okay, are there any questions? We'll see this. I have not, of course, shown the solution here. But we will see a signature of this singular horizon later as we carry out the analysis. Okay, somewhat indirectly, but we'll see it anyway. Now, this seems to be bad news, okay, because on the one hand, the statistical entropy has a perfectly good finite answer, but the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy seems to be zero. Okay? And furthermore, the horizon is singular. But of course, we know that this cannot be the final story. Okay? Even though the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy appears to be zero, the very fact that the horizon is singular means that some corrections are important at the horizon. Okay? That supergravity approximation clearly breaks down at the horizon because the horizon becomes singular. So given this, we can then try to analyze which kind of corrections are important near the horizon. Now, as we all know, string theory contains two kinds of corrections to the supergravity approximation. First of all, there are these alpha prime corrections, okay, higher derivative corrections, which all appear at string free level. And then there are the usual quantum corrections, okay, which of course appears in all theories, all quantum field theories. They are all quantum theories. So there are two different kinds of corrections that one can envisage, that these two different kinds of corrections have the possibility of repairing this singular horizon that we found. One can show, and we'll see this later in a somewhat indirect fashion, but again, we'll see this explicitly, that the string coupling is small at the horizon. In fact, larger the values of n and w, the smaller the value of the string coupling at the horizon. So this shows that if we are analyzing the theory, analyzing the black hole solution for large values of the charges, for large values of n and w, then we can ignore the string loop corrections. Because string loop corrections are controlled by the value of the string coupling at the horizon. However, the same analysis also shows that the higher derivative correction terms are in fact large at the horizon. Not a surprise, because the geometry is singular at the horizon. Okay, so the higher derivatives of the Riemann tensor and higher derivatives of the Riemann tensor becomes larger and larger as you approach the horizon. So what this tells us is that while we can ignore string loop corrections, we cannot ignore the three level higher derivative corrections to the effective action. So we must include the effect of the three-level higher derivative corrections to the string effective action, and then redo the analysis that we did earlier. Okay, we have to re-evaluate what the horizon geometry is. We have to recalculate the entropy, and then we have to compare with the statistical entropy that we had found earlier. So this sets our goal. Okay, so the goal then is to construct the effective field theory that describes heterotic string on this particular space, compactified on this particular space. But in this effective field theory, we only want to keep three-level higher derivative terms. So we need to keep all possible higher derivative terms, but only at three-level heterotic string theory. And once we have done this, we go ahead and calculate the black hole entropy in this theory using the techniques that I described earlier. So this then is the task that we need to carry out. Are there any questions? Okay, so now I'll start doing the analysis. And we can see that to do an explicit analysis of this problem is a very hard task, because you are supposed to include all possible higher derivative corrections in heterodic spring tree level and then redo the analysis. Okay, how do we go about doing it? We'll of course not be able to take into account all possible higher derivative terms, but what we'll do is to not specifically look at the problem, the explicit solution of the problem from the beginning, but try to use various symmetries to analyze the problem. And only at the end we'll try to go for an explicit analysis. Okay, we'll go try to go for an explicit form of the action. So we'll proceed without assuming any very specific form of the action and see how far we can get. So let me begin by stating the convention. My convention will be that I'll set h bar equal to 1, c equal to 1, and unfortunately, alpha prime equal to 16. Okay, this is more for historic reason. I just was too lazy to change the convention back to alpha prime equal to 1, so we have to live with this. So I'll use this coordinate x9 to label the coordinate along the circle S1. And I'll choose a convention where x9 is periodic with period 2 pi times square root of alpha prime, which in this case is 8 prime. This does not mean that I'm choosing the radius of S1 to be 4. What it says is that I'm choosing the coordinate radius of S1 to be 4. But of course, I can switch on the metric in this background. And depending on what the value of the metric along S1, depending on the 99 value of the 99 component of the metric, I can have different radii of S1. Okay, it's just that I'm making a coordinate choice such that this coordinate is periodic with period 8 pi. Now, in 10-dimensional heterodic string has many fields. Okay, we'll be interested most only in the massless fields. So among the massless fields, it has a dilaton, it has the graviton, it has antisymmetric tensor field, and it has also many gauge fields. It turns out that the gauge fields are irrelevant for our analysis from the beginning. Okay, because since our heterodic string that we have taken, okay, which carries just winding and momentum along the circle S1, they don't carry any gauge charges, and hence all the gauge fields can be set to zero from the beginning. Okay, so we'll not have to worry about the gauge fields that appear in 10 dimension. From the beginning, we just set them to zero. And then, to carry out this analysis, it is more effective to rewrite everything in terms of a d-dimensional effective action. Even though, in principle, we should start from a 10-dimensional effective action and then carry out the analysis, I can always choose to reduce this 10-dimensional effective action, rewrite, re-express this 10-dimensional effective action in terms of effective d-dimensional fields, because the rest of the dimensions is compact anyway. So here are the various fields which are relevant for our problem. Okay, there are of course also other fields which are present, okay, but those are not switched on in this background. Okay, the particular black hole solution that we are looking for do not have any non-trivial background involving those fields, and hence I have not even written down those fields here. So in particular, all the shapes and sizes of this compact space M, okay, are totally irrelevant for the problem that you want to study. So what we do is that we define our d-dimensional fields. This is the dilaton. Okay, this is defined in terms of the 10-dimensional field in this way. I define a field S, which is nothing but the exponential of the dilaton. Okay, so this effectively measures the inverse string coupling. okay, or the square of the inverse string coupling. And this is going to be important in future. So you should remember that this field S essentially is measuring the string coupling, okay, or the inverse of the string coupling. Then I have this field T, which is square root of the 9-9 component of the metric. Okay, this measures the effective size of S1. And then I define the four-dimensional metric G mu nu, and the four-dimensional gauge fields in terms of the various components of the metric and the anti-symmetric tensor field. Now, as I said, these are, I have only introduced these fields because these are the only fields which take non-zero value in this black hole background. All the other fields are set to zero, and hence I have not bothered to define those other fields in this case. You notice that some of these relations I have written down here because these are the relations I'll need to use later. Okay, so in particular, I have written down the expression for the T field in terms of G99 and also the two gauge fields in terms of the anti-symmetric tensor field and the components of the metric in 10 dimensions. Okay, are there any questions? So now, what one can do is to take the 10-dimensional effective action. Suppose you knew the 10-dimensional effective action. Then all you have to do is to rewrite those 10-dimensional effective action in terms of these new variables that I have introduced. Okay, new variables which I am calling the d-dimensional fields. And if you consider, there is a supergravity limit of the 10-dimensional effective action. And then rewrite them in terms of the d-dimensional field, what you get is an action of this form. This, of course, is a d-dimensional supergravity action. Okay, the relevant part of the d-dimensional supergravity action. There are, of course, various other bosonic, various other fermionic terms, and some other terms that I have not written down because those are not relevant for analyzing the black hole solution that you're looking for. And then, of course, there are all these higher derivative terms which you don't know what they are. You may have some knowledge of some higher derivative terms, but certainly not all the higher derivative terms in the theory. So in this theory, we want to look for a black hole solution which carries charged quantum numbers n and w. So the first question is, how do we recognize a black hole that carries charged quantum numbers n and w? The way we recognize it is by noting the definitions of the fields of the two gauge fields. So look at the gauge field mu1. Okay, mu1 essentially is constructed from the 9 mu component of the metric. And the 9 mu component of the metric naturally has its source as a momentum along the 9th direction. Right? Because the metric couples to the energy momentum tensor. And one can easily verify that the particular component of the energy momentum tensor that the 9 mu component of the metric couples to is nothing but the momentum along the 9th direction. So this tells us that the charge associated with the gauge field A1 must be proportional to the quantum number n that we had introduced. Right? Because n is nothing but a measure of the momentum along the 9th direction. And one can show that the precise relation between the charge associated with the gauge field mu1 and the quantum number n is given by this relation. Over here, there is a simple factor of half. Similarly, mu2 is coming from the 9 mu component of the antisymmetric tensor field. And you know that the source for antisymmetric tensor field are the fundamental string winding charges. And hence, the source for mu2 will be winding number along the 9th direction, which is nothing but a quantum number w. Again, a somewhat detailed analysis tells us that the precise relation between the charge Q2 associated with the gauge field mu2 and the quantum number W is given by this relation over here. So we'll keep this in mind. We'll use them later. And so I have also listed the relationship between the Q's and the N's and W's in the in this box over here. Okay, in the box on the left hand side. Okay, are there any questions? Okay, so what we'll do now is that given this problem, so we have set up the problem, we have not given what the Lagrangian density is completely, but given this problem, we now set up, we now carry out the analysis exactly in the same way that we set up earlier, okay, that we described earlier. So we assume that the black hole solution has near horizon geometry, ADS 2 times S D minus 2. So it will have a metric of this form. This is the ADS 2 part, this is the S D minus 2 part. There are two scalar fields that are relevant to the problem. The S field, which effectively is the inverse spring coupling, and the T field, which effectively is the square of the radius along the circle S1. So they are values at the horizon are constants Us and Ut. And finally, there are these electric type gauge fields, Fi, whose values I'll denote by Ei. Okay, so F1 RT is E1 and F2 RT is E2. These are again constants because we want to have this as the symmetry of ADS2 times SD minus 2 to be respected by this background. The point to note is that this particular black hole solution that you're looking for does not carry any magnetic charge. It does not carry any magnetic charge because the fundamental strings, these being elementary excitations of the system, will only carry electric charge. The magnetic charges are typically carried by various solitons in the theory. So by construction, by the very fact that we are looking for a fundamental string carrying certain amount of winding and momentum, tells us that this, we are looking for a state which carries electric charges but no magnetic charge. And that's why we don't have any magnetic charge term in this background. So given this background, we'll define our function F. Okay, it's a function of the scalar field, Us and Ut, the sizes of ADS2 and SD minus 2, V1 and V2, and the two electric fields. Exactly by, as before, by integrating the Lagrangian density over the SD minus 2. And now, as I said, we don't know what is the full form of L. In the absence of a knowledge of the full form of L, we'll first try to analyze the problem based on various symmetries that we are aware of. So the first feature of this Lagrangian density that we are aware of is that because we are working at the tree-level heterotic string theory, we know that at the tree level, the dilaton field appears in the Lagrangian density as an overall multiplicative factor. So if we evaluate this object, the constant, the parameter that labels the dilaton field, namely Us, must appear as an overall multiplicative factor in this function. In other words, this function, even though it was a function of a function of six independent variables, the dependence of this function on Us is somewhat trivial, that Us must appear as an overall multiplicative factor, and then you have a function of the other variables. Again, this is a feature of tree-level string theory, because tree-level string theory, by definition, we'll have a 1 over coupling constant squared in front. Okay, there is no other factor of coupling constant squared inside the action, okay, except for this overall multiplicative factor. But of course, once you start including quantum corrections, this feature is not true. Right? One loop action, for example, will have coupling, will not have a 1 over coupling constant squared in front of the action. So by the very fact that we can ignore the loop corrections, we are allowed to pull out this factor of Us in the expression for F. Is this point clear to everybody? Why can't I use? Yeah, because it's only if you are using a string metric that the dilaton appears as an overall multiplicative factor. If you use a canonical metric, then different terms have different powers of the dilaton. Right? But once you express everything in terms of the string metric, the dilaton factors out. Right? And that's what I'm using here. Okay, are there any questions? No, okay. The point is the formula for entropy that I wrote down, that is independent of what metric we use. Okay? You can use Einstein metric or you can use string metric. The additional factors all cancel out. Okay, so you might as well use string metric to do this analysis. Okay, but you will get exactly the same answer if you use Einstein metric, except that the scaling will be more complicated. Okay, because some factors of US would have gone into V1. Right? V1 and V2. Okay, are there any other questions? Because this was an important point that if normally when we say that the entropy is area over 4 times a Newton's constant, that is the area measured in the canonical metric, Einstein metric. Okay. However, the formula that I used, okay, which was given by Wald and others, that formula is insensitive to which metric we use. The Lagrangian density, a tree-level heterotic string theory, has another symmetry. This is again only a symmetry at tree level and not once you include loop corrections. And this symmetry takes the following form. It involves scaling t by a factor of e to the beta and the mu1 by a factor of e to the minus beta and the gauge field mu2 by a factor of e to the beta. This essentially is a consequence of a scale transformation involving the compact direction. You simply scale the x9 coordinate by e to the minus beta times x9. The result of that will be a rescaling of the metric component 9,9 by e to the 2 beta, the 9 mu component by e to the beta, and 9 mu component of b by e to the beta. And if you now look at these definitions of t, mu1 and mu2, which is given here, you recognize that this is exactly the transformation that I have given there. Now, I should emphasize that this scale transformation of x9 is not a genuine symmetry of the full theory. It's not a genuine symmetry of the full theory because x9 radius I have already fixed to be 8 or 4. So if you make the scale transformation, then effectively you are changing the radius of compactification, which obviously is not a symmetry of the problem. Right? The string theory at a given radius is different from string theory at a different radius. However, if we are looking at the neutral fields, which is what we are doing here, and if you are not including loop corrections, then the effective action involving the neutral fields is insensitive to this radius. Okay, because all you have to do to get to this effective action is to simply say that you start from the 10-dimensional effective action, take all fields to be independent of the x9 direction, and evaluate the action. Okay, that procedure doesn't care about what the radius of x9 was. Once you include loops, then, of course, the charged particles will start propagating in the loop. So the effective action will get a contribution where the charged particles are propagating in the loop. And obviously, the masses of the charged particles do depend on the radius. Okay, so let me emphasize again then that this symmetry is a symmetry of the tree-level effective action involving the charge neutral fields, but not a full symmetry of string theory. Nevertheless, since we have already said that we are only using the tree-level effective action because that's what the relevant action is for this problem, we can use this symmetry. So if you use this symmetry, that gives a relation on F, Okay, this is simply a reflection of this fact, this symmetry, that if we replace qt, the value of t, by a scaled variable value, e to the beta times ut, and if we replace the electric field associated with the a1 field by e to the minus beta times u1, and the electric field associated with the a2 field by e to the beta times e2, the function f should remain the same. And if we combine this relation with the previous relation that I gave, namely that us factors out in the expression for f, we see that what it tells us, that this function f, which to begin with was a function of six variables, can in fact be thought of as expressed in terms of a function of four variables. Okay. Essentially, what we have done is to determine the dependence on two of those six variables by using symmetries. Okay. The dependence on US is just as an overall multiplicative factor, and dependence on UT is a little more complex, but nevertheless, it's given explicitly in this form. Is this point clear? So you are essentially using the symmetry to rewrite f, okay, which was a general function of six variables, in terms of a simpler function of four variables. So the function itself may not be simpler, but at least it depends on less number of variables. And in fact, you would recognize that this relation is what I have written here. Okay. I have just introduced these new variables, y1, y2, y3, and y4, which you can call the scaled variables. Okay. And in terms of the scaled variables, I can write f as us times a function of, this is y1, this is y2, this by my definition is y3, and this by my definition is y4. Okay, are there any questions? Okay. So here are the same expression again. F in terms of G and the scale variables, y1, y2, y3, y4. And now all you have to do is to implement the equations of motion that you are supposed to solve, okay, but translate them in terms of this G. First of all, we have the equation. We are supposed to extremize F with respect to the U variables and the V variables. Right? So in particular, we have to have del F del U S equal to 0. What does it tell us? It tells us the G must vanish. Right? Del F del U S is simply G. Similarly, del F del U T equal to 0, you can easily verify by chain rule of differentiation. Tells us that y3 del g del y3 must be equal to y4 del g del y4. Del f del v1 equal to 0 just gives you del g del y1 equal to 0, because v1 is the same as y1. And del f del v2 equal to 0 gives you del g del y2 equal to 0, because v2 is in fact the same as y2. So this is the only equation which is a little complicated, and the reason that there are two terms in this equation is because both y3 and y4 depends on ut. Right? They depend on ut in opposite way, and that's why you have this equation over here. And finally, we have the relations q1 equal to del f del e1 and q2 equal to del f del e2. And again, by chain rule of differentiation, you can rewrite del f del e1 in terms of del g del y3, because y3 is proportional to u1. So these are the relations you get. Okay? Q1 is given by this expression over here, and QT is given by this expression over here. And here I have written down the equations for G. Okay, so these four equations give the equation for G, and these relate Q1 and Q2 to Y3 and the Y1, Y2, Y3, and Y4. Are there any questions? So we have these six equations, but four of them are somewhat special. The first four, the ones which do not involve Q1 and Q2. So you see that G is some kind of function which is calculated in terms of the action. Right? It doesn't know anything about Q1 and Q2. And here we have four variables to determine, Y1, Y2, Y3, and Y4. And we have four equations. So in a generic case, we should be able to solve these four equations to determine these four parameters, y1, y2, y3, and y4. And the point to note is that because these equations do not involve any factor of q1 and q2, this should give universal values of y1, y2, y3, and y4, which do not depend on q1 and q2. So these yi's that we'll get by solving these equations will be just some numerical constants, depending on what the effective action was. Okay, it doesn't depend on the charges. And now we use the two other equations to determine Q1 and Q2. So here are the expressions or not to determine Q1 and Q2, but to determine US and UT, okay, in terms of Q1 and Q2. So these are the two other equations. So we can see that you can easily combine this, okay, take the product. That gives you US as this, and take the divide the first equation by the second equation, and that gives you UT given by this. Okay, so to begin with, you have a ratio of the derivatives of G, but then using this equation, you can convert it to a ratio of the Y's. So this is then the general structure of the solution. Okay, we get a set. Okay, four universal numbers, y1, y2, y3, y4, and then US and UT are determined by these expressions. US and UT, of course, depends on the charges. And now you see why it is consistent to ignore string loop corrections. Because US is the effective string, inverse string coupling square at the horizon. Right? Because US is the value of S, and S measures inverse string coupling square. We see from here that for large charges, Q1 is, here it is, Q1 is half N and Q2 is half W. So when N and W are large, okay, these are of course just some universal constants. So when N and W are large, US is large. And large US means that the string coupling square is in fact 1 over US, so that goes as 1 over square root of N times W. So for large N and W, the effective string coupling at the horizon is small. And this is what shows that the string loop corrections are not important, okay, at least in leading order in N and W. Are there any questions? Okay, so here I have collected a subset of the various equations which have appeared here, okay, in these blocks. Because these are the equations which are relevant for calculating the entropy. So what is the entropy? Remember that once you have solved for all the fields, the entropy is given simply by the Legendre transform. So it's 2 pi times E1 Q1 plus E2 Q2 minus US times G. And so now what we do is to use these equations to rewrite everything in terms of N and W. Let's see how we do that. First of all, you use these equations to write E1 in terms of Y3 and UT, and E2 in terms of Y4 and UT. Then you use these equations to rewrite US and UT in terms of the charges and the Y's. And at the end of all this, you see that the expression for the black hole entropy is given by 2 pi square root of nw times square root of y3 y4. Okay, it's a straightforward algebra. And now we see that because the yi's are universal, I have already argued that yi's are obtained by solving this set of first 4 equations, which have no dependence on q1 and q2. So yi's are just some numerical constants, okay, which have to calculate using the full effective field theory action. But because the yi's are universal, the expression for the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, or the modified version, the modified Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, is given by this expression over here, where this constant k is a purely universal number. Right? K is essentially square root of y3 y4 over 2. And this is something that I have already pointed out before, that since US is of order square root of nw, it is large for large n and w. Hence, string coupling at the horizon is small. Okay, this explains why strict loop effects are not important. Okay, are there any questions? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. If the function g is given, and the way to compute g is also known, right? Once the Lagrangian density is known, you just plug it in and calculate this function g. Okay? So I'll work out some example soon. So if we compare now, we see that both the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole and the statistical entropy has exactly the same dependence on n and w. Right? We had found earlier that the statistical entropy is 4 pi times square root of nw. And what we see is that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is again square root of nw times some universal constant, which you haven't been able to calculate yet. Okay, I'll discuss the calculation of k in a few minutes. So clearly, it's encouraging that S BH and A-stat has exactly the same dependence on N and W. Okay, this is something that you can derive without making any commitment as to what effective action we have. Okay, just from general symmetry principles, we can see that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole and the statistical entropy has exactly the same dependence on the charge quantum numbers N and W. I should also add that although I have presented this argument in a more modern language, okay, based on an ER horizon geometry of ADS2 times S2, the result, in fact, is more general. Okay, the fact that the modification of the black hole entropy is of the form of a universal constant times square root of nw, this you can argue even without assuming any form of the ER horizon geometry. Okay, and indeed, this was given long time ago, almost 10 years ago, okay, without assuming any form of the ER horizon geometry. But what I have done is to just put that in a more modern language, okay, taking the postulate that the ER horizon geometry is ADS2 times S2. So then, of course, the question is it possible to calculate this constant k? And as I said, if you really want to calculate this constant k, you have to know the action of the Lagrangian density to all orders in alpha prime. This has not been done because nobody knows how to write down how to calculate the Lagrangian density to all orders in alpha prime. What has been done is the following. In 4 dimension, this constant k has been calculated by taking into account a special class of higher derivative terms which come from supersymmetrization of the curvature squared terms in the action. We know from string S matrix calculation that the heterodic string effective action has a term involving square of the Riemann tensor. So what these people did was to make a supersymmetric completion of that curvature squared term. Okay, so they wrote down a complete set of terms, okay, which includes also gauge fields and other scalar fields, okay, so that you have a completely supersymmetric version of this Lagrangian, including the curvature square. And what has been done is to calculate the black hole entropy, okay, in that field. Okay, it is still not the complete effective action, but for some magical reason, if we calculate the black hole entropy in this theory, where you only take into account supersymmetrization of the curvature squared terms, you get exactly the right answer. Okay, you get k equal to 1. Okay, and this is the result that double got found. Are there any questions? It could, certainly. I mean, there is no argument, as that I know, no concrete argument which says that the higher corrections will not affect change the result. These terms are in a sense, okay, somewhat special in the sense that these set of terms are the ones that are calculated using this topological field theory. So one, I mean, school of thought is that in some sense, what these terms are doing is to calculate an index rather than an entropy. For heterodic spring, index happens to be the same as entropy, and that's why you're getting the correct answer. But again, I mean, there is really no, I mean, proper justification as to why these terms should carry any, should calculate anything. Okay? Whether they should calculate index or entropy, there is no real argument. Okay, except that these are somewhat special terms in the action. In the conformal field theory. Yeah, so that certainly is something that, I mean, I think many people have thought about, but I don't think there is any understanding of what conformal field theory describes this. But that will certainly be the right way to go about it. That just construct a conformal field theory which describes this near horizon geometry, okay, because we are allowed to ignore string loop corrections, so conformal field theory should be enough to give us the answer, but that has not been done. That is certainly, I mean, I would say that that's the only right way to go about it. Okay? If you don't have, I mean, otherwise you only have to, I mean, hope that some approximation schemes are better than others. Okay, are there any other questions? Yeah. That? Yes, certainly there is no a priori justification as to what could be ignored and what could not be ignored. Because we saw that because the alpha prime corrections are important, they are of all of order 1. Right? In principle, if you really want to do an honest calculation, you have to include to all orders in alpha prime. Okay, that's the reason why Nathi was saying that you should really use conformal field theory. Because it's conformal field theory techniques have the possibility of taking into account all orders in alpha prime fields, right? If you, for example, find an exact conformal field theory that describes this system, that will know about all orders in alpha prime. Now, I'll not do this calculation, but I'll leave this as an exercise. Okay, so here is the exercise. So the exercise is to calculate this function f after taking into account the correction terms arising from supersymmetrization of curvature squared terms. Okay. You of course need to know the full supersymmetrization of the curvature squared terms, and you can easily read it out from this review article by Mohab. Okay. You have to do a little work because the language in which I have set up the problem, okay, the variables that I have used are related to the variables that are used here. They are not directly that variables that are used here. So you have to know the language that translates between, for example, the electric and magnetic fields in this paper to the electric and magnetic fields that I have used in my analysis. Okay. And that you can find in this paper. So you can find the translation, the language that translates from the variables of this to the variables that I have used here in this. So once you know the language of translation, you should be able to work out the function f. I have given you all the algorithm completely. The only extra ingredient is that the way the supergravity action has been formulated, it also has some auxiliary fields. Okay, so besides these regular fields, S, T, etc., you have some auxiliary fields, and you have to also introduce parameters which level the near horizon values of those auxiliary fields and extremize with respect to those parameters. Okay, but it's a straightforward job to do. And then once you have calculated your F, you calculate the entropy function F, extremize it, and evaluate its value at the extremum, and show that the result is 4 pi times square root of entropy. Okay, it's just algebra. Okay, are there any questions on this? Yeah, not completely, but there is some hope that there is a simple formula, because okay, the entropy function F is the Legendre transform of this small f, right? So let me see if I can. Okay, let me come back to that in a few minutes. Okay, because I mean I'll try to indicate that perhaps getting an expression for the entropy may not be a very complicated object. Okay. Okay, I'll show the formula anyway and then we'll come back to it. Okay. So in the last 10 minutes, what I want to do is to illustrate the method by considering a different truncation of higher derivative terms for general dimension. I do not hope to get the complete answer because it's just an arbitrary truncation of higher derivative terms. But what I want to demonstrate is that it is possible to get a finite value of this constant k by including higher derivative terms. So first, we'll begin with the supergravity approximation and show that the supergravity approximation does not give sensible answers. We know that it must be true because in the supergravity approximation, I said that the horizon becomes singular. Right? So there must be some signature of that in our analysis. Okay, let's see how we see that. So the supergravity approximation to the effective action is given here. This is something that I wrote down earlier. So all you have to do is to simply take this, evaluate this for the near horizon background. Okay, here it is. The near horizon background is given here. So just substitute this background in this Lagrangian density and do the angular integral. And the answer for f is given here. I'll explain where the various terms come from. So first of all, this omega d minus 2 is just a result of angular integral. 32 pi is here already. Square root of minus determinant of t gives you this factor of v1, v2 to the d minus 2 by 2. And this s gives you the factor of us. This Riemann, the scalar curvature, gives you two terms, one from ADS2, which is a function of V1, the other from SD minus 2, which is here. And finally, okay, the scalar field kinetic terms, of course, don't contribute because these involve derivatives of scalar fields, which are zero. So the only other params which contribute are the field strengths. And once you put this in, this gives you an ut square, u1 square over u1 square, and this gives you ut to the minus 2, e2 square over u1 square. So that's what f is. And we are supposed to extremize this f with respect to various parameters, right, the u's and the v's. And we'll not do the complete extremization, but we can easily check that this has no solution. So first, we have to impose del f del u s equal to 0. Right? Del f del u s equal to 0 means the term inside the square bracket must vanish. Right? Because u s is an overall multiplicative factor of this whole thing. Okay? So this is one of the equations. Term inside the square bracket is 0. And then we have to impose del f del v2 equal to 0. So where does the v2 dependence come from? There is a dependence here. So when you take the derivative, there is a term where you take the derivative of this, but that is multiplied by the term inside the square bracket. That is 0 by the US equation. So that term doesn't contribute. The only other source of contribution is the derivative of this term. Right? D minus 2 times D minus 3 over V2 square. The minus sign. That, of course, is not 0. Right? For finite V1 and V2, we cannot make that 0. So you see that it's inconsistent to demand that both del f del u is equal to 0 and del f del pt equal to 0. Essentially, what this tells us is that there is no non-trivial solution with ADS 2 times S2 geometry. Okay, and that is the reason why in the supergravity approximation, we did not find a smooth horizon. Okay, we encountered a singular horizon. Okay, is this point clear? So what we will do now is to add to this action a specific hard derivative term whose existence is known to us. And this is what is known as the Gauss-Bonnet combination. This is a term that appears in heterotic string, pre-level heterotic string theory. It's given here explicitly. And this coefficient C, in fact, is also known. It's equal to 1. I have kept it as a constant C so that when I write down the final formula, we'll be able to track down the precise effect of this constant C. Okay, so you should be able to set C equal to 0 and see that the solution doesn't make sense. And this combination is nothing but the Euler density in 4 dimensions. In 4 dimensions, this is a total derivative. Nevertheless, this total action gives a non-trivial effect because even though this is a total derivative, it's multiplied by the dilaton field. Okay. So given this, we get an additional contribution to this function f, okay, which is obtained by integrating this, carrying out the angular integral of this object that evaluated for this background. And this is the answer. Okay, this part is the same as what we had before. This comes from the angular integral, and this comes from the determinant factor. This is just the factor of S outside. And then we have this object. Okay, this is what we get by evaluating this for this background. Okay, are there any questions? So now you simply have to solve these equations, right? The standard equations that you have been dealing with all the time. It's a straightforward algebra. So F is now the total F, okay, the original supergravity F plus this delta F that I showed. You just take this total F and try to solve these equations, and you find that indeed there is a non-trivial solution, and that is given here. So this gives you V2 and V1. Okay, as you can see, that for C, once you set C equal to 1, these are just universal numbers, as you had predicted from a general scaling analysis. This gives you not directly US, but a combination involving US. And you can see that this indeed is proportional to square root of NW, as we had predicted using scaling analysis. And these are the values of the T field and the electric fields. Okay, so this is just straightforward algebra based on the modified F. And using this, we can now calculate our black hole entropy. And here is the answer. So what this shows is that indeed, we get a finite value of the constant k. We don't get the right value. But of course, we shouldn't have expected perhaps the right value because we have only included part of the alpha prime corrections. Okay, so the purpose of this analysis is to essentially demonstrate that it is possible for the higher derivative terms to modify the near horizon geometry and make the singular horizon into a non-singular horizon and give a finite value of the entropy. And once it gives a finite value of the entropy, by the general scaling analysis, we know that N and W dependence must come out correctly. It's only a question of the overall coefficient, and that's what we have to determine if it's correct or not. Okay, so now I can come back to the question that Siraj was asking, that if we had a conformal field theory, would you be able to recognize what quantity to compute for the entropy? Now, I don't know the complete answer, but what we see here is the following. That if we are working at a tree-level string theory, then the equation, one of the equations of motion says that F is 0. Right? Because of the overall multiplicative factor US, F is always 0. Is this clear? Okay, you can see here. This was the form for F. Right? So the US equation of motion tells us that one of the equations was G equal to 0. Right? And of course, if G is equal to 0, then F is also 0. So for a tree level, the black hole entropy is given by just the product of the electric field and the electric charge. And I suspect that this is something which may have some kind of realization in the conformal field theory. Okay, it's built out of things which we understand somewhat better. Okay, it's not, entropy is somewhat of an abstract quantity, but electric field and electric charges may have a specific realization in the conformal field theory. Okay, I don't know what it is, but this is something which one has to look at. Does that answer your question? Or okay, so I'm at the end of my talk, but I would just like to note that if we take this expression for the entropy, then in D equal to 4, you get the answer 4 pi. Okay, exactly as you want. Okay, and one might ask whether this is an accident. Okay, the fact that, so we have, in D equal to 4, we have two defined truncations of the full effective action. One was the supersymmetrization of the curvature squared terms. The other one was inclusion of the Gauss-Bonnet term. Both seem to give the same answer, 4 pi, even though there is no justification in either case. And one might explore whether there is some kind of non-dimensional theorem that is going on in the four-dimensional case. Okay, so with this, I'll end. And since this is the last talk, I would like to end by thanking the organizers again for organizing an excellent school. And so you should all give them a big hand.
Jessica can't be with us today, otherwise I would have brought her here.